Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. On this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman will discuss the latest happenings on Capitol Hill, including in the House Ways and Means Committee, which held a series of markup hearings on NAHU's priority legislative issues. We will also review the latest Trump administration announcements on the ACA's Risk Adjustment Program and Navigator funding, as well as President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and how he may shape forthcoming healthcare cases coming before the court. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop this week for the Washington Update podcast was the House Ways and Means Committee advancing a series of HSA-related bills that would modify the spousal rules, allow consumers to use funds on on-site clinics, and for seniors on Medicare to contribute to HSAs. How has NAHU worked to shape this process, and what is the outlook in getting these changes enacted?
Well, thank you for joining us. Chris and I have spent a great deal of time on the HSA improvement proposal. As written, the bill was pretty solid. It included chronic care, preventive care, it equalized treatment in terms of the definition of the law around age 26 and a number of other things, because in fact, we've never updated HSAs to really fit the market that we're in today. And so there's a lot of pent up desire to do some things. And so after carefully crafting this legislation, the Ways and Means Committee actually stripped it back. And I think that they lost the messaging war with Democrats when they did that. They've stripped out the chronic care provision. They've peeled back a number of other provisions and watered them down. And yet then they added some provisions that employers are not asking for, such as a doubling of the contribution limits. In fact, only 8% of people fully fund their HSA today. Actually, doubling the contribution limit would push more plans into the Cadillac tax. So I'm not sure what we're doing here. If this is a messaging exercise, what it looks like to me, then surely they can bring it to the floor. It can pass because of the numbers, but it goes nowhere in the Senate. Had they done what we had discussed in the original Kelly Blumenauer bill, bipartisan, that would have gotten the Senate's attention and had maybe a chance to get some action in the Senate.
So what was the mood in the room? As you mentioned, this started off with a bipartisan bill that we thought everyone was going to be on board with and was going to be somewhat easy to maneuver through the markup. And now we're getting these hiccups. So being in the room when they're doing those markups, what were the feelings on both sides of the aisle and some of the kind of nonverbal cues that you get to pick up when you're actually sitting there watching them?
There were actually a lot of verbal cues. And for the Democrats, it was really around the pre-X question, diminishing the ACA, not being serious about doing things that really help people, and that sort of thing. It resorted back to the old arguments against health savings accounts, that they're for, you know, the healthy and wealthy kind of argument again. But I hate to say it, but I feel like Republicans just sort of let this happen when they diminished the intent of the original bill. And they didn't ask the employer community in any meaningful way what it were our needs, even though we spent a lot of shoe leather on this, trying to go office to office and explaining why this package was good. I think maybe if we had a failure here, it was to offer to help them more on the messaging of the Kelly Blumenauer bill that could have really gotten it across the finish line.
Yeah, I think we appreciate that the committee is putting a focus on HSAs. Like we talked about in the past, HSAs really haven't been updated to stay up with the world that we live in. We're really talking about a large package of bills. The Kelly Blumenauer was a series of things that we were very supportive of. To reduce the cost of this, we lost several things that we were interested in, like being able to use your HSA for chronic care or being able to use your HSA for your kid who's still on your plan. We unfortunately lost some of those things.
That's because currently they can only use that HSA up to age 18, even though they can stay on a parent's plan to 26.
Yeah, you know, when the ACA came through, one of the things that's very popular is being allowed your child to stay on the plan until 26. What I don't think most consumers even realize is that you're only allowed to use that HSA on them till 18. That did not change with the ACA. So there's a lot of things here that I actually worry that a lot of consumers are doing currently with their HSA. Maybe it's direct primary care. Maybe it's using an on-site clinic with their HSA that isn't currently legal. And while the IRS hasn't caught up with you yet, doesn't mean they won't sometime in the future. And so I think a lot of what we were looking to have happen is try to update these rules to keep up with the way the world is and try to make it a little more logical that if you can keep your kid on your plan till 26, then probably the HSA should stay with them till 26. But the bill is reduced. I think also the way that the series of bills was presented in a markup wasn't particularly helpful for the messaging.
So, Chris, when you talk about the way that these bills were marked up and the fact that we're not working with one bill, we're working with several bills, how exactly were these bills presented for markup?
There's a series of bills on here that are not bipartisan. When it comes to HSAs, you see the real split around expanding HSAs, meaning more people can get HSAs or how much money you can put into the HSAs, which is something Democrats are not on board with. You find comfortability amongst Democrats about what you can use that HSA for. I think in this full series of bills, which includes some things that have nothing to do with HSAs, including the employer mandate, other sorts of pieces of legislation here, the sheer cost of all of these bills is going to add up to $91 billion. As you heard very strongly back from Democrats, why aren't we paying for this? There is no offset here. And if we are going to be spending $91 billion, is this the right place to be spending $91 billion? So I think part of the problem came in when we combined some bipartisan things like being able to use your HSA for fitness, for gym memberships, for your kids' sports activities. Those were very bipartisan. And then we combined it with raising the caps, which is something I know bankers and others are looking for. But we aren't hearing from employers that that's quite as important to them. And so I think combining all of these bills from the non-controversial to the very controversial in the same markup has also soured the discussion and allowed Democrats to talk about $91 billion of unpaid for tax cuts for HSAs. And HSAs already have a reputation of being something that only people of a certain income can afford to use. And so, unfortunately, I think it allowed that negativity around HSAs, where it's for a certain class of people, to be expanded the way that the bills kind of lined up, as opposed to some of the more modest bills that NHU has been backing of really having a shot of getting all the way through the process.
So, Chris, how does the timeline affect support? As we've already seen, it's taken us about 6 months to get to the markup here where we are with several bills. And we're also looking at a timeline where we're heading into August recess and we're less than 4 months out from the election cycle. How do you think this will affect the success rate of getting this done?
We are getting really close to election time. And so I realize that we're getting into that funny season that people go into their camps, they're looking for messages to run on. I was really very hopeful that a couple of these could get through all the way to the Senate and pass the Senate because they are on the more non-controversial side. But I think when you look at these bills in a full package, you're not going to find that sort of bipartisan support to go through.
The wellness and fitness bill today got six Democrats on it. So who are they listening to then? If they're not listening to us, who are they listening to? Well, they're listening to the right-wing think tanks because they have already posted on their website how supportive they are of this bill. There are no employer support letters on that website. They're not talking to us about it. And so there's a great frustration among employer groups that they're not being heard. But just to go back to Chris's earlier point, we're happy that HSAs are being discussed in the committee because I'll tell you what, 6 months ago, they weren't going to go there. They weren't even going to entertain an HSA package of any sort. So that we got to, at least to have this conversation, I think is positive. Just not happy that they've peeled it back the way that they did.
The House Ways and Means Committee also considered legislation to delay the ACA's employer mandate and further delay the Cadillac tax. What are the prospects for these legislative efforts?
I think that this feels very political, messaging again. While we would appreciate relief from the employer mandate, I feel like this is really just a tactic to, you know, message around it, the ACA. In terms of the Cadillac tax delay, we're pushing for full repeal. We have a solid 295 co-sponsors. This thing is veto-proof. And we believe that we're actually going to achieve 300 co-sponsors. So why not just repeal the whole provision?
And with the piece where they're looking at delaying the ACA's employer mandate and the enforcement there, it's important to remember back a couple of months ago when a lot of the 226J letters were going out to employers about penalties for the 2015 plan year, that NEHU did sign on to a letter asking the administration to suspend enforcement of the employer mandate, basically until they could figure out exactly how to be able to collect these penalties without violating the process in which it's laid out that the government is to follow in order to collect them. So we do take a lot of interest in what is going on in the Ways and Means Committee when they're looking at this.
Yeah, you know, I'm pleased that the committee is looking at the employer mandate and also the Cadillac tax. This has been something that we've been asking for some time. I think a lot of people in our community would be quite comfortable with a repeal of the employer mandate. That does not get everybody out of employer reporting rules, but we would be pleased to see a repeal of the employer mandate because most employers are going to offer their employees health insurance. Before the ACA, 96% of large employers were already offering their employees health insurance.
With that statistic, it's measuring large employers as over 500, since sometimes we think of large and small employers differently under the definitions of the ACA. I just wanted to point that out.
That is true. Versus 500 versus the 50 definition. You know, I think what this unfortunately probably does still fall into the messaging bill category. I think we could see some more progress on the Cadillac tax in the coming year, possibly a delay. I will also say if we see a repeal of the medical device tax, which I think is something possibly coming down the pipeline, I would be really annoyed if the Cadillac tax and the HIT tax were not given the same consideration. I think all three add to the cost of healthcare in the United States. A worry that the medical device tax elimination seems to be gaining more momentum than elimination of the other two. And we need to keep up the pressure on eliminating the Cadillac tax and the HIT tax because consumers feel that probably the most directly. I don't disagree that the medical device tax adds cost onto those devices that are then eventually absorbed by consumers. But the Cadillac tax and the HIT tax are more directly something that a consumer is paying for out of their paycheck day in and day out. And so first, ideally, we'd like to see a repeal of both of those. But a delay would also be something that we would be very interested in.
Well, and as much as we support a delay of the HIT and Cadillac taxes, we're obviously still working towards a full repeal of both of those taxes. How do you think repeals of these taxes could make it through both the House and the Senate?
I think this might have to be something that happens in a package where Democrats and Republicans feel like they're both giving and getting some wins and then having to give on a few points. A standalone bill on this matter is not likely to go through in a bipartisan way, particularly if it's packaging the employer mandate with the Cadillac tax. I think you're likely to see that go up more as a Republican-only effort. But like I said earlier, we're getting close to Election Day, and I realize that more of that's going
to
happen.
I talked to some leadership members this week about this very question, and I'm like, well, if you're messaging on device tax, why don't you message on the other bills? I mean, now I'm not saying that I necessarily want them to do a message bill on the Cadillac tax, because in some ways it sends the wrong message to our Democratic friends. But if they would just put our bill up, straight up or down vote, like I said, it's veto-proof. Let's do this. And I was told that, you know, it's a fair question and that there may be multiple opportunities. Something's going to happen on Cadillac tax this year. So they're doing, like I said, these series of messaging bills at the end of this month. And then in September, they're going to do another, some sort of tax vehicle will be available. Maybe it rides on that or in lame duck. So
yeah, when John talks about our bill, he's talking about the Kelly Courtney complete repeal of the Cadillac tax legislation that we are just about to, on our 300th co-sponsor. As you know, it takes 218 votes. So the fact that we're up to 300 co-sponsors demonstrate there is a wide bipartisan support for getting rid of the Cadillac tax. I would be very excited for them just to put this piece of legislation onto the floor. I think you would see resounding support for it passing. And so that would still be our ideal situation in this legislation battle. Obviously, we would also take further delay of the Cadillac tax, but you see the support out there with 300 co-sponsors for just repealing the bill. And they are all types of people, from the most conservative Republican to the most liberal Democrat, who just realized the Cadillac tax is not going to work for consumers.
And remember, a couple of years ago, obviously, a different congressional session, a different president in the White House, we did have the repeal of the Cadillac tax pass with 90 senators voting in favor of repealing the Cadillac tax. And then it was vetoed by President Obama, and there wasn't a veto-proof majority in the House to help out with overturning that veto. And then even as recently as this last summer, when we had the night of the Voterama, the epic night with John McCain giving his thumbs down on the skinny repeal bill, one of the pieces that they were voting on there was a repeal of the Cadillac tax. And it passed with an overwhelming majority, but because the overall bill didn't pass, that part didn't get into the package. So we are seeing a history of support here, but are just kind of running into some technicalities where we're not able to get it to the floor and get passed. And so I think we do have a president who would sign this. So if we can push this through and get it, like you said, 300 co-sponsors in the House and have it gain support in the Senate, there's a good shot there.
The Trump administration announced last Saturday that they would be freezing payments on the ACA's risk adjustment program, citing conflicting court rulings. How will this affect health insurance rates for consumers as we approach the 2019 plan year?
So the conflicting court decisions that Dan is referencing are one from the District Court of Massachusetts that ruled in favor of the calculations that are being used for the risk adjustment payments. And that was in January of this year. And then subsequently, the District Court of New Mexico released a decision invalidating the use of statewide average premiums for payments on the risk adjustment program. The government has since moved for reconsideration by the Court of New Mexico. They have not released a decision as to whether they will even revisit their previous decision or if they will stand firm in the ruling that they made. Things to kind of remember here, because of this ruling, no payments can be made or collected until there's a final decision on this. So it does literally freeze things, I think was one of the terms that Dan used in the question. It freezes these payments. They can't be made or collected. There are a lot of different pieces that can happen here. Anytime there's uncertainty in the market, and this is definitely something that is uncertain when we're talking about billions of dollars that are going to carriers as part of this risk adjustment program. So carriers are going to be concerned about this. Anytime we see this type of uncertainty in the market, we see premiums rise. I think this is going to possibly be very similar to when we had the announcement that the cost sharing reduction payments were no longer going forward. And we saw premiums rise and insurance companies beginning to get very nervous about what the market could bring. So we're going to see a lot of uncertainty here. Because there are two different district court rulings with different opinions, the likelihood that this is taken up onto a higher level for an appellate court is very likely. Oftentimes, if there's still a challenge after more than one court has heard a similar case, the fact that an appellate court would take it up is unlikely if the lower courts all agreed on their decision. But here we have a disagreement between the District Court in New Mexico and the District Court in Massachusetts. So if we don't see New Mexico going back and revisiting their decision based on the government's motion, then we could possibly see this going forward into some type of appellate case. There is also a chance that CMS could act to clarify the language in the rules that talks about the exact calculation that needs to be used for specific years for risk adjustment payments, but it's uncertain right now, and there haven't been any announcements that have come out from CMS to indicate that they are even looking at doing this and are instead looking for the courts to decide the matter.
Yeah, I think, again, this is just another thing that adds to market destabilization. You know, we saw early on risk order issues. Now we're cost sharing reduction payments not coming through. Now you're seeing risk adjustment program payments not coming through. If I'm an insurance carrier, I just sort of say, what's next? Like, now the individual mandate has been zeroed out for 2019. Like, how many things are you constantly just throwing at me? And I have some actuary working with his tables and numbers in the back trying to price this plan, which is starting to become a guess, because who knows what will come next year. If all these things happen this year, how do I know next year there won't be some other court ruling changing how plans can work for things, for example, pre-existing conditions, which can add more unpredictability to the market. So the insurance carriers are trying to not only factor in the known knowns, but starting to try to worry about like the unknowns coming down the line. And this was something that, you know, when plans came out in the last couple of months with their proposed rates, we're not factored in, but we still have several states that are left to factor in this with their rates. And so I think you'll see adjustments. You might even see plans wanting to go back to refile. This particularly hits a lot of the Blues plans very heavily. And we know how many of your states particularly have the Blues. I spoke to several of the Blues carriers, and particularly for the smaller ones, I think this is going to be very predictable. You know, larger versions of them, Anthem, they can wait several months without getting $1 million payments and things. But if you're a small Blues who is in only one or two states, not getting that payment, you factored all that in. And so you don't want a scenario where we start to have small Blues who feel more like the co-ops, who they're just starting to worry about their actual bottom line and solvency in the states. And so they have been relying upon these payments for the last several years. And a large, healthy one can survive it, but a smaller regional and Blue Cross carrier might not be able to survive continued loss of these payments over the long run.
The Trump administration released their latest round of Navigator grant funding, leaving $10 million available for groups this fall after cutting $26 million. They've also instructed navigators to inform consumers about the new association health plans after the final rule was released last month, and the forthcoming short-term plans, where the final rule is expected to be released in the coming weeks. As consumers look more to agents for health insurance coverage, what is NAHU doing to ensure that consumers are fully educated on these plans in the new open enrollment period?
So we feel very strongly about this. Recently, there was a report that came out from CMS that noted that agents enrolled over 40% of consumers that were entering marketplace plans. That is compared to less than 1% by navigators over the last 2 years. And so the administration really pointed to this and the fact that the navigators were enrolling less than 1% of those coming in through the exchanges as a reason to defund their program, saying that the return on investment there is just not good enough. However, with this new announcement or statement by Seema Verma that they now believe that navigators should be able to instruct consumers on short-term plans and association health plans, we here at NAHU are very concerned about this. The current training for navigators does not include information about short-term plans or association health plans. The training is only limited to marketplace plans. The rules for navigators instruct them only to discuss plans that are on the exchanges. So we have actually reached out to folks at CMS to ask the question about whether there will be forthcoming rules about how these navigators can act in these different markets. And hopefully, really by pointing out that there do need to be changes to training and rules and all of these other pieces, pointing out to CMS that there really is no need for these navigators to try to expand the markets in which they're assisting consumers, because agents and brokers are already fully licensed in all of the states. They have training in almost all of the markets that are going to be available. Obviously, many of you specialize in different markets, but you're much more well-informed and are required to do continuing education and all of these other pieces so that you are the experts that the consumer should be going to try to get into some of these plans. And this is not something that we should be trying to ask navigators to now instruct consumers on, because it's really just not within their scope of practice of what they do. And it's not within the scope of the rules under the ACA of exactly what navigators were intended and are able to do.
I guess I don't understand why the administration has, on one level, decided to cut navigators back. We saw last year significant cuts to navigators, this year down to $10 million. So we're reducing the amount of navigators that will exist and will be out available in the community. But we're now expanding the advice they can give to all sorts of things that are higher risk, more complicated, and that really brokers are trained for and get continuing education on. Why would you want to reduce the amount of navigators, but then say, we're also going to give you more responsibility and higher risk?
So there are a few different views on this. One borders on conspiracy theory. So I just have to preface it with that. Some folks think that this is an attempt by the Trump administration to increase the enrollment in short-term plans and in association health plans, plans that some folks are criticizing as possible junk plans. And so by having these entities out there assisting consumers in promoting those products, it's a way for the administration to undermine the ACA and to sabotage the markets. Like I said, this is more of a conspiracy theory behind the question that you asked. I think the other part of trying to dial down on the amount that they're giving towards the navigators while also asking them to perform these other functions is that they have seen with a return on investment that when we're looking at agents and brokers, when they look at the funds that are provided to agents and brokers for training and for having them participate in the market, and then we look at how many people agents and brokers bring into the market, the cost to the government is about $2.50 per person that an agent brings in into the exchanges. When we look at the navigators, it's about $500 per person that the government is spending on grants and funding and other things to try to get people enrolled into the exchange. So I think that even though they're reducing the amount that they're giving to them, they're thinking that by opening up more markets that the navigators could possibly assist consumers in enrollment with, that their return on investment will be better because there's more options for them to discuss with the consumers. This, again, is comparing the agents and brokers here that are just enrolling in the exchanges with the navigators that are only enrolling in exchanges when we look at the statistics of the cost analysis that I just mentioned. But of course, we know if a consumer is working with an agent or broker and they go in thinking that they want to enroll in an exchange product, agents and brokers are able to talk about off-exchange products that may be a better fit for that consumer. And right now, navigators are restricted from doing that. And so it's interesting because in some of the statements that have been made by the administration about expanding what the navigators can discuss with consumers, the statements that have been released have been about allowing them to also talk about short-term plans and association health plans, but not about allowing them to talk about plans that are offered off of the exchange. So I think a lot of the statements that have come out from the administration leave more questions to be answered than anything else. This may have been an idea that came up in a meeting and they decided to go ahead and kind of release a statement that they're thinking about this or considering it. But NEHU is going to be very involved with CMS. Like I said, we've already reached out to them about this and are looking forward to having some meetings with them to really show that agents and brokers are providing this value every day. on a much higher level than the navigators are able to based on the difference in training and making sure that we continue to offer a space for agents and brokers to assist consumers.
I don't think that the carriers are rolling out the welcome mat for navigators to bring them this kind of business either. They're nervous enough about that, right? They want the best trained, you know, the agents and brokers that they have strong relationships with to work with in this business. Short-term limited duration plans have to be underwritten. That is not the role of a navigator. That is the role of the agent.
Right. And we have worked really hard with the Navigator Rollout Program since it started in 2013 and have worked really hard with states to try to implement some type of either licensure certification or just a registration with the state insurance commissioners so that the insurance commissioners are aware of these entities that are acting in their states and advising consumers on even the exchange plans, which are very technical and can be hard to understand. And so I think we had almost half of the states implement laws to try to regulate navigators in some fashion. I think if they're trying to expand their abilities, we're going to see states really acting in stronger force to try to restrict what navigators are able to do, the background checks, fingerprinting, continuing education, and things like this. Also comparing it to, like you said, with the carriers and their willingness to want to work with navigators on these types of more technical plans. Navigators aren't appointed with carriers. That's not how it works. So it's going to be very interesting if carriers will even want to participate, knowing that their plans are or could be sold by someone that doesn't have the appropriate background that an agent or broker has when they're looking at these plans and looking at what's best for the consumer.
The announcement felt a little to me like they were thinking out loud.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think when you look at what navigators have traditionally done, you're talking about on-exchange products, and there's a certain standardization to on-exchange products. There's the essential health benefits, the time period, pre-existing conditions, all these sorts of things are standardized on that. And if we're starting to talk about products that don't have that standardization, short-term duration plans, association health plans, those still might be the right plans for a consumer. But now you need somebody who's really studied this, that really understands the risks that you're now taking. And only an agent and broker has that training to explain the real risk that somebody's taking on by taking, say, a short-term duration plan, that things may not be covered that you were traditionally used to having covered if you went on to healthcare.gov. That's not to say that plan doesn't have value, and that still might be the right plan for that consumer, but you do not want to end up in a situation where someone untrained without expertise has now signed somebody up for a short-term duration plan that they are not aware of what that plan actually covers and then gets sick and is uncovered for it. And I think really what you're likely to happen there is a New York Times story is then likely to come into fold of someone who took this short-term duration plan, signed up by a navigator, and then really the pendulum will swing in the other direction. We tighten up the entire system because of somebody who's not properly trained on telling the consumer the risks that are possible with these particular plans.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I don't want agents to get the black eye for behavior or lack of knowledge, I should say, of a navigator.
Mm-hmm. Agents and brokers are already at the ready to be able to work with these plans, with short-term limited duration plans and association health plans. You all have the resources to be able to do that. I know with the new AHP final rule, the old pathway is still there. So if you are working with AHPs previously, that pathway is still an option as a way to form an association health plan. But then the new pathway that was finalized under the rule that recently came out is another option. And we're making sure that our agents and brokers are going to be well informed about this. We had a podcast just a couple of weeks ago with Janet Trotwein, our CEO, going over what was new from the final rule. And then next month on August 16th, we are having a compliance corner webinar that will go through everything that you need to know about putting together an association health plan underneath these new rules. some of the biggest comments that we had on the comment letters for association health plans and short-term limited duration insurance was about consumer protections and making sure that the consumer knows what they're getting enrolled in. And I think to all of the points that we've made here, the only way that they're going to get that information is if they're working with a valued, trusted, licensed expert like an agent or broker, and the navigators just don't fulfill that position.
President Trump named Brett Kavanaugh as his nominee to fill the soon-to-be-vacated Supreme Court seat of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Based on his background as a federal judge and in the Bush White Houses, what can we read into how he may rule on forthcoming legal challenges, including the case where the Trump administration has decided to no longer defend the ACA's individual mandate and consumer protections?
So it's interesting enough, Kavanaugh was sworn in by Justice Kennedy when he joined the D.C. District Court of Appeals a few years ago. He also clerked for Justice Kennedy, so they do have this close relationship, and it seems very symbolic that Kavanaugh is now up for nomination for Justice Kennedy's seat. Kavanaugh was also the Solicitor General under the Bush administration. What that means is that you're a lawyer that represents the government before the Supreme Court. And a lot of what he did was not necessarily focusing on some of the issues that we look at, but he was very instrumental when we were going back to even before Bush was elected. He represented then candidate Bush in Florida during the 2000 recount of the votes and ultimately argued before the Supreme Court for installing him as president. And so Kavanaugh was very instrumental in George W. Bush being sworn in there. His views on healthcare, however, are something that I think both sides of the aisle are going to be very interested in. He heard one of the lower court cases on the individual mandate, and instead of coming out with an opinion specifically on the individual mandate and whether it was constitutional, he dissented and wrote his own opinion saying that basically they couldn't hear the case yet because it was prior to any of the penalties being levied. And so since no one had been taxed yet, they couldn't hear the case. So he avoided kind of going on the record as far as whether the individual mandate was constitutional. But he's also made some other comments that are very interesting, that he believes that any future president may decline to enforce the ACA if, as president, even if not supported by the Supreme Court, if the president thinks that it's unconstitutional, that the president can decide not to enforce it, even if the Supreme Court does not agree with that. So this is going to be, I think, a point for a lot of questions during the Senate confirmation hearing. I think another point that will bring a lot of questions is that Kavanaugh actually represented Elian Gonzalez. If we all remember from several years ago, I think in the 90s, the little boy from Cuba, he defended Gonzalez to keep him from being deported back to Cuba. And so I think when we look at the issues that this country is facing now, the Senate is going to have a lot of questions on healthcare, and they're going to have a lot of questions about immigration. Kavanaugh is 53 years old. We know Trump wanted someone a bit younger on the court, so we could possibly see him on the bench for three decades. I don't know. But depending on what kind of healthcare he gets and see how long he'll stay around. But he also has a long history. I think Senator Dick Durbin joked that Kavanaugh is the Forrest Gump of the legal community. He just keeps popping up in all these different places. He was involved with the Ken Starr investigation during the Clinton administration. So there are going to be a lot of questions for the Senate to go through. But one thing to keep in mind is that as they ask questions, sometimes the most important questions are the ones that don't get answered, because those are the ones that Kavanaugh will try not to go on the record on as having an opinion about a certain issue, to try to avoid any attention in that area, to try to then be confirmed later on. So if he has strong opinions about something, or if he believes a Supreme Court decision will hold steady and hold firm, he's likely to answer questions about that. more so than he will about questions that he may not think the Supreme Court ruled appropriately and may need to be revisited. And those are the questions that be much more vague and are the ones to look out for to kind of gauge exactly where he is on certain issues.
Finally, it's time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour's Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to?
This week, we're toasting to the House Ways and Means Committee for doing a markup on the HSA bills. This is something that has been a long time coming, and we're really looking forward to moving these bills along and hopefully seeing some progress after August recess.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.